Welcome to a very special edition of the Public Square from the American Policy Roundtable. This is a weekly program. I'm Wayne Shepherd, and along with producer Alan Duncan, we're going to be introducing you today to a conversation Dave Zanotti had with John Beckett, the author of The War Letters. And you'll learn why this book is so special in just a moment.
Wayne, good public policy is supposed to keep people safe and hopefully keep a nation at peace. But sometimes things happen otherwise, and people choose to do otherwise. The 20th century witnessed a period of wars unlike any other in modern times. From almost the start, much of the world was in conflict during two periods of war, World War, that impacted the globe.
Today, we journey back to the early 1900s and hear the story of a young man from Canada who left his home and family to serve in the Great War, World War I. The story is told by his surviving son, American author and businessman, John D. Beckett. His book, The War Letters, is the text we now open in today's edition of The Public Square.
This is a picture that was taken at Shorncliffe just as he was finishing the final stage of his training. And the soldiers always had in mind that this could be the last. I'm sure that's true today, too, but it forces a certain line of thinking when you realize that maybe the last picture home, the last letter home. And so this was a professionally done picture. We're so grateful that we have it because it's just a marker of where he was on the eve of literally going into the intense conflict. Everybody lived with devastation on every front. There were 10 million deaths of the military alone in that war. There were probably another 15 million civilian deaths. There were more deaths after the war than during the war because all the infrastructure was destroyed. There were plagues, there were vermin, there were just every form of disease. And so it's hard for us to imagine how a continent can be so devastated. But that was the nature of that war. We have other pieces of memorabilia that, somewhat to my embarrassment, were in storage for 100 years. They were literally in this mahogany case. It's not a large collection of memorabilia, but it's as good as I've seen in any museum in the world. We just feel privileged to have it. And now it's out of the storage case and, you know, where people can enjoy it.
When I talked with you this morning about this book, which I just reread again last night, this is your best work right here. The War Letters is so good. And let's start from the historical point of view, because we are losing our history. And let's look at what's happening to our kids and to our grandkids. You guys have 17, 18?
Well, we had, yes, 18th born last year. So you're right almost on both counts, okay. But we're up to 18.
18 grandchildren. And what's happening to our kids and our grandkids in history classes, there's just not enough time. And what we've done with a lot of federal policy on teaching to tests, you know, for this high-stakes testing thing, has made the lengthy love of the liberal arts, including history. When I say liberal arts, I'm not talking liberal politics and I'm not talking paintbrush. We know around this table what we're talking about, but even that terminology has disappeared. The thinking stuff, including writing and history and poetry. And World War I is chock full of poetry.
Do you know, I was in Belgium and France last year visiting the sites. And I come down for breakfast in the hotel that we're staying in Ypres, in the north of Belgium. And there are a group of fine-looking young men and women, and they have an iPad out, and they're looking at what they're going to see that day on the battlefields. And I, intrusive guy that I am, just said, "Would you like to meet the son of a World War I veteran?" And it turned out they were West Point cadets. And we had the most delightful engagement, part of which was to read them a poem that my dad had written home and I have recorded in the book, because they were studying poetry. West Point cadets were studying the poetry of the First War, as well as seeing the battlefields. It was very, very integral to the language of the time that even soldiers would try to put their feelings, their emotions, into poetry.
Well, they weren't sending emails, and they had a lot of time on their hands in between the battles, and there was a great amount of reflection from which came this endless stream of letters back and forth between your dad and your grandfather.
I'd like to show you the letters themselves.
Okay.
And we can kind of go from there. Now, they weren't in an attractive box like this. They were in a ratty old file folder. There's a whole generation who don't know what carbon paper is. You'll notice that it was pre-staples, and so straight pins held multiple copies together. But the significance of these is that my grandfather took handwritten originals, sat down in the evenings at a typewriter like we have on hand here, and typed these out with multiple carbon copies to distribute to my father's siblings. And so this is the first of the letters that we have from France. And the dating on it is very significant. It was 2 days before the beginning of the Battle of Vimy Ridge. It's likely that one of the thoughts going through his mind at this point was that it would be his last letter home. We now know that, A, they won the battle, which in itself was very significant, but at a very high price, because there were over 10,000 casualties, including 3,600 who were killed. We have 60 pages of typewritten letters, and we now know that my grandfather wrote or sent packages to my dad on the average every other day for 3 years.
And the time is the question I wanted to get to, because history takes time. Studying history takes time. And in our academic settings today, we're extremely busy. Everything is compressed, and there's so much data. And let's just take a second to be fair. There's more history than there was every day. So how do you pick what you're going to study? And what we end up with is so much of the paragraph plan. You know, we've got to do lesson planning. We've got to get from here to there. And there's only so much time, and there's a lot of tests. And things like World War I, they're not focused upon. In fact, World War I and World War II aren't focused upon. Even more frightening, we get to the place where when we do this chronologically, we can get through a semester, and if we get behind in school, we can miss 50 years.
I was talking to a history professor the other day, and he talked about the tyranny of the school schedule, because they have so much material to get through, and they couldn't get through it all, but they were doing it chronologically, just as you say. And by the time they got to the 20th century, they were out of time. And so these seminal moments in the history of nations never really get covered in the schools.
Well, we're talking about World War I as the Great War. And
why was it called that?
Because
nobody expected a Second World War, so it wasn't called the First World War.
That's right.
They just called it the Great War. It was the war to end all wars, wasn't it?
This conversation will continue, the war letters, with our very special guest, John Beckett.
But first, here's a bit of a classic song from the era, Keep the Home Fires Burning, in a new arrangement by dear friends of the public square, Chris and Jan Harris, Rodeo, and Juliet.
They were summoned from the hillside. They were called in from the glen. And the country found them ready. stirring call for men. Let no tears add to their hardships as the soldiers pass along. And although your heart is breaking, make it sing this cheery song. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning. Though your lads are far away, they dream of home.
Spreading the light of liberty across the land. Now back to the public square.
The guest on the public square today is our friend John Beckett. And John has written a book called The War Letters.
Now, let's go back inside the Beckett Corporation offices, where the family houses a World War I collection of memorabilia that rivals a museum.
A very significant event happened actually on the 4th of July of the previous year, 1916. And we're looking at what's called an attestation paper. This is a paper that is completed when a soldier who's enlisting goes into a recruitment office and fills out this form. So this is my dad's handwriting on the attestation paper. The significance of this date is that he enlisted literally 3 days after the Battle of the Somme was commenced. So he wasn't in that battle, obviously. He was at the beginning of his training. But on that day, which was the 1st of July, 1916, a massive engagement with the German army began. On that day, one day, there were 20,000 British soldiers killed on the first day. And this had to be all over the headlines at the time. And so this was not the euphoria that occurred at the beginning of the war in 1914, when everybody was rushing to get in so they could be home for Christmas. This was the sober reality that this was a ugly, difficult, near impossible war. And yet that's when he went in to enlist.
We tend to think as Americans of wars as 4-year or 5-year segments. We forget that the War for Independence was 8 years. But we got in this idea that wars are supposed to last about 4 years. It's just what we come out with the paragraph form of school. Well, and World War I did, in fact, the Great War last about 4 years. But America was involved in World War I for 1 year, 7 months, and 5 days, I think.
They came in 1917. You may recall that a trigger event was the sinking of the Lusitania.
The sister ship of the one that your dad...
The Mauritania, which my dad sailed over on.
Sailed over on. To go to war.
And even with that horrendous affront to Western civilization, a passenger liner being sunk by a U-boat.
And not by accident.
Not at all. No. No, there's a book on that subject now, which is just fascinating. It's from the standpoint of the German U-boat captain, and it was intentionally targeting a passenger liner. Now, did it have munitions on it? Somewhat debatable, but it was a provocation that was almost intentional to bring the U.S. into the war. And yet it was 2 years later, in 1917, that our first troops arrived. The good news is that when the U.S. did engage that war, it was in such a massive way that it broke the back of the German resistance. and it was very seminal to the ultimate outcome of the war. But we were in Leyden, so even from the standpoint of that window of history, it's truncated compared to, say, the Second War or other wars.
It's interesting because you talked about the influence of the United States getting in, and we talked about the poetry. Let me just take a minute, and this is a reflection from your dad from the battlefield, and it's a poem. And, of course, he was reflecting on Algonquin Park because your family has always had a love affair with the wonderful majesty of the Canadian wilderness. And so he spent a good amount of time fishing up there.
Right, and that was it's a park about 200 miles north of Toronto. It's visible on any map of North America, but the family was one of the first to have property there and build a cabin, and so yes, the memory of it was very very alive with him as he was over in the war and imagining this pristine park in the north of Canada.
Let me take a minute. It's a brief poem. It says, "Oh, how I long for the feel of a paddle again. The sound of the ripples as they gently splash against the side of our canoe. The splash of a trout or a big black bass. The little camp most hidden away, the sizzle of bacon too. Back to nature where there's not to break one's sleep, the sound of the guns, or an SOS, or a duty to be done right away. And nature's not marred by the hell of those guns, the havoc of modern war, but God's own land, and the peace that he grants to a country we call our own. At night when all seems still, the scratch of a mouse or the bark of a wolf, the hoot of an owl to its mate, the beautiful sun as it tops o'er the trees and smiles on a day just begun, a day we can call our own. But there's work to be done. We're to beat the damned Hun. Until the victory won, 'tis but our only thought of the battles unfought and the fight that is yet to come. But we'll see it through if the world will wake up and send us munitions and men. The goods to see us through, and after that, when the battle's fought, the boys will be home again." That's good work.
It's very special.
From Reg Beckett.
Yeah, and that's not in the history books, but there's one that is, and it's called In Flanders Fields, which in Canada, where he grew up, today, they still learn by memory. And it was a William McCrae, a doctor, who wrote that poem after he was asked to take the memorial service for his close friend who had been killed in a battle in Flanders, in the Belgium area of Ypres. And it's a precious piece of poetry and perhaps the most famous. So we know that, but there are many other obscure poems that also have the poignancy of the battle and the battlefield. It's a memorable part of that war.
One of the things that I find so fascinating in reading war letters, in listening to you talk about your dad's reports back home to a family he dearly loves, and you make a pretty good point that he's trying to help them not to worry, trying to protect them to a degree.
He says he worries more about their worrying about him than he worries about himself.
And you thought, well, that's going to wear out sooner or later, because he was there in some very brutal and difficult times. And any of us that have read All Quiet on the Western Front and understand the concept of no man's land can understand that this was epic ugliness in the human experience. We're talking dead animals. We're talking dead bodies.
Millions of horses.
Millions of horses and millions of people killed in this war and maimed and wounded in this war. Weather was often awful, and trench warfare which began at the end of the Civil War, is now reenacted again to an extreme level.
A friend of ours found an actual Canadian issue Lee Enfield rifle, and this is what every soldier in the British Army carried. And the bayonet was at their side, and before they'd come out of the trenches, this would be mounted on the end of the rifle. And if you've seen war movies, you've heard the click, click, click down the trenches, mount bayonets, and they slide into the end of the rifle, and when they come out of the trenches, the rifles and the bayonets are up in the air, and they're now in motion.
And yet, that horrible, dark, gray, bloody, smelly, awful experience doesn't emanate from those letters.
He started smoking for a reason that I've never heard elsewhere. Of course, we're in 1917. We don't know the health risks of smoking. It was very common. But it was to mask the stench of dying men and horses. And it was a way to try to get a little bit of relief from what was unrelenting odors that would just turn you upside down.
He was clearly focused on doing his duty and getting home, and believed in the mission, and remarkably upbeat, continually upbeat. Now, I recognize that, you know, he's trying to encourage his family. His large family with his six other siblings, right? There's seven kids in the family, six boys and one girl.
Right.
And he's got two brothers that are also engaged in the battle at some level, either deployed.
One brother preceded him. Mm-hmm. The other achieved a captain's rank, but did not serve overseas because of some medical difficulties. So it's just my dad and one other who are actually overseas.
But I just don't get letters of huge complaint.
No, they're not. It's an interesting observation because there was lots to complain about, as we've just said. And I'm sure that he didn't want to overly worry his parents. But there was also just an underlying, is optimism the right word? But it was a kind of cheerfulness, in spite of the circumstances, that he wasn't going to be just inundated by what he was seeing and experiencing. I believe that he saw the end, and the end was victory. We see that thread through, and at various times he maybe misgauges how long it's going to take. But I see that positiveness in the outcome. Why? Because I believe that he felt the cause was right.
Yes, the cause was just. You sensed that coming.
Germany engaged what was called the Schlieffen Plan to do a big right hook across Belgium, which was a neutral country, come down into France and take Paris. And they wanted to do that so quickly that they could be in a position to have control of Paris and France by the time Russia mobilized on the Eastern Front. And so if we think about how much the map of the world has been altered today as a result of that war, imagine how much more it would have been altered if they had been successful in taking Paris, if they had been able to subjugate France and Great Britain, no doubt was in their sights, it would have been radically different. So there was good motivation on the part of the British Empire and the French to withstand this aggression.
There is more to come in today's conversation of the public square between Dave Zanotti and our friend John Beckett.
Again, John's book is called The War Letters, and you can learn more about these inspiring letters and the messages they still teach by visiting us at thepublicsquare.org. thepublicsquare.com.
That's thepublicsquare.com, where this program is also archived, so you can pass the link along to others to listen to what you're hearing today on The Public Square. We will continue.
Spreading the light of liberty across the land. Now back to The Public Square.
Today on The Public Square, a very personal and powerful story told by John Beckett in his book, The War Letters, a true story from his own family.
Interestingly, a number of Canadian churches went together to provide two little booklets that were packaged in a way that they could carry them in their uniform, Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, and Congregational. And so the first of these booklets is called Quit You Like Men from the Scripture. In other words, discharge yourself like men. And it's select verses of the Scriptures. And then a second little booklet called Prayers and Hymns. And so these are a collection of prayers that the soldiers could pray. So here is a country at war, and yet the church is doing what it can to actively support the troops. Speculate all you want about whether it was a just war in any sense. It was probably one of the most confusing entries to a war that history has ever seen. There's a picture with Queen Victoria with five or six other relatives who all became combatants. I mean, the Tsar of Russia, the Kaiser of Germany, they were all related to each other.
It was an ending of the ancient empire approach across the nations of Europe and the families of Europe. Now, what's really significant about this and how it's all connected. You say, well, gee, that's nice. Maybe I'll, you know, make a movie of it and I'll watch it someday, you know, on at home on DVD. This is all connected because what you just described was the path that Hitler would take just a few years later, just a few decades later, because it's almost as if World War I was the precursor of World War II, and we're going to do this all over again, and France is going to fall to the Nazi Empire.
In fact, one way you can look at it, Dave, is that it was a continuum.
Yeah, it didn't stop.
We had this lull during the 20s and part of the 30s, but in some ways, it was a fight that didn't really get settled.
And now you say, okay, that was over there. You know, the old song Over There, and it's a great song and catchy one. And there were a lot of great songs from this era as well. But over there, and for America, it was the last war where we could rely upon what the founders understood in the beginning, is that America was a vast empire from ocean to ocean, and no one could really come get us because we were so big. As America expanded, you could attack with ships on the East Coast, but good luck getting to Kansas, right? I mean, we were virtually an impenetrable fortress because of geography. But shortly after World War I comes World War II, and how does the United States enter World War II? Not with a ship in the middle of the ocean, but with Pearl Harbor. We are attacked. And in that moment, everything in the American concept of foreign policy changes because we, at that moment, and to this very moment now, because of technology, are no longer immune from being attacked. And that's a massive change in the American mind.
And you think about how this period of time foreshadowed that, because the U.S. and Canada, the very geographical region you're speaking about, took the war to Europe. October 1914, 2 months after Great Britain declared war on Germany, Canada has mobilized 32,000 soldiers, sending them over on 30 troop carriers. We penetrated that vast ocean going the other way. And it was really kind of the precursor to the fact that we ourselves were more vulnerable than we ever have been. And Pearl Harbor was the first chapter in that, and 9/11, in a way, was the second. Our oceans no longer protect us the way they did.
And our technologies now expose us with the ICBMs and missiles and technologies now that rogue nations and small nations can strike out all over the world. So you say, well, gee, that's really encouraging to me right now. I'll sleep much better realizing that. But this is the reality of what those in elected office come to understand in a very real, vibrant way, and those in our military, is that there are real threats in the world. There are people who, for reasons that, God bless us, American folks probably are never quite going to grasp, really want to see America fail. They want to see America destroyed. So there is a real threat, there is a real evil, and it has historic chords that go the whole way back.
And the evil that you're describing is from within. And when the enemy's within, mm-hmm. the borders they're totally redefined. Ultimately, we're fighting a war of ideas. We're fighting the war of whether we're a constitutional government, whether our freedoms that we can so easily take for granted are really worth protecting and even dying for. And we have developed, I'll be kind about it and talk about a soft underbelly. It may be worse than soft, but it's internal. And we have generations of people who do not understand the uniqueness of our nation, the heritage that we have, a gift of God. And so in this perverse way of thinking, they flail out against it. We'll never fight another war like World War I. We'll never have soldiers coming out of trenches, Lee Enfield rifles and bayonets raised, running across muddy fields strewn with fellow soldiers, tanks, planes, the things that made that war will never happen again. But we're no less vulnerable. The nature of the enemy has changed. And we have to have a different kind of vigilance because we're fighting a different kind of warfare.
It's popular to dislike America. It's in the air. It's in our institutions. We make fun of ourselves a lot. And we love to, from the internal fight, show up each other's afflictions and hypocrisies. It goes beyond the sort of thing you get in a big family with sibling rivalry where I'm going to show you I'm better than you. It's corrosive and it is eroding. There's a theological element in it that I find a lot. There is a growing hatred. And I think what's happened is we've hollowed out our core understanding of the ideas of America, where those ideas come from. And we're only looking at a very little piece of America in a very brief period of time. And if we lose our identity, we don't know where we've come from, then we are just adrift. And this is what's happening in our culture. This is, to me, what the real culture war is all about.
We've done a lot of things wrong as parents. You mentioned our 6 children, 18 grandchildren. I think one of the things that we did right was to push our kids not only out of the nest, but overseas. And all of them have either worked overseas, they've studied overseas, they've gotten firsthand experience on the rest of the world. And I think it's one of the most valuable things that we were able to do for our children. And when you dig deep among those who are whining the loudest today, whether it's people out protesting or whatever, they really don't have an intrinsic appreciation for who we are as a nation. One of the ways to get that, I think, is to see us as others see us. You have to go abroad to experience that.
There's more, and we'll return to this conversation with John Beckett and Dave Zanotti here in the Public Square in just a moment.
You can learn more about these treasured letters and the messages they still teach by visiting us at thepublicsquare.com.
Over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums rum coming everywhere. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over over there.
We will be right back for more on the Public Square.
Let's return now to The War Letters. Our guest is John Beckett, along with Dave Zanotti here on the Public Square.
Dave, I don't understand the antipathy toward our nation, hatred. I'd love to engage others on that, where they hold that view. But I think you may have touched on an aspect of it that gets overlooked, and that is the spiritual dimension. It is the opposite of love, isn't it? It is the opposite of care and regard and gratitude and the other qualities that help describe who we are as people of faith. And it's flying in the face of that. So I don't find that people who are alive spiritually carry that spirit.
That's a very substantive point, and it goes back to war letters. It goes back to World War I. It goes back to the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, at that time. Because Woodrow Wilson, elected as president in 1912, taking office in March of 1913, we used to inaugurate presidents in March, gave a speech titled, What is a Progressive, in 1913. And in that speech, he is the first United States president to actually, in public, in writing, to attack the founding. He was the first president to say that the Declaration of Independence was built incorrectly. He acknowledged the fact that the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, was in fact built upon what he called Newtonian principles. Harkening back to Newton and to the concept of science and Christian science and presuppositions and a creation monotheistic Judeo-Christian model. In essence, he said, that model is no longer sufficient by which to understand the Declaration of Independence, and we must pick up the Declaration and now move it to a Darwinian base of principles. He said this out loud and wrote it in the speech, What is a Progressive?
So really a very fundamental shift that has had profound consequences.
And every president who's been a progressive, whether they're Republican or Democrat, since Woodrow Wilson, has consistently worked on the theme of reinterpreting the Declaration according to a godless equation. So it's understandable why people would not understand any longer the concept that America was birthed to set captives free. The idea that it was birthed as personal liberty against totalitarian regimes. It was built as becoming all that the Creator designed you to be, and government serving the people, not people serving the government. This was the whole concept. That's why it starts this way, at the Declaration of Independence. And it's why that the progressives have understood that they must desperately work to reinterpret the model to extinguish the old way as anti-scientific. That's where the whole concept from Wilson going forward, that these documents, including the Constitution, are living documents that have to be reinterpreted in the issues of the day. So we stop teaching our founding, and people have either no affection or they develop a disdain for our country. We've hollowed out our core.
So what do we do? I think of the scripture of the foundations are destroyed. What will the righteous do? What should the righteous do? And I believe that what you're doing and have been for decades is a piece of that. We have a breach in our public life that perhaps by God's grace can be restored. The foundations can be repaired. The wars that we've fought are part of the equation because it was the concept of holding back the enemy at the gate. But when the enemy is internal, the breach is different. And the remedy is different. It's not guns. It's the war of ideas, as we mentioned earlier.
It is a war of the American spirit.
It's the American spirit. And the target audience is, 330 million people who have to be won over, so to speak, one person at a time. To their inheritance, their privilege of living in a land that was constructed as uniquely as we were. It will be a challenge for not just our lifetimes, but the lifetimes of our children and our children's children, if we're to prevail. Is it worth fighting for? Those of us who have seen the alternatives say it has to be, because ultimately the alternative is the destruction of the human spirit altogether.
I think that's why history is so vitally important, because when we see the lessons of history, we may well indeed save ourselves a grave amount of suffering, because we can compare outcomes. It's one of the reasons why your dad, Reg Beckett, is a hero to me, because he couldn't wait to do his duty, and the whole time he was there to do his duty for liberty, all he kept saying was, I wish I'd got here sooner. And that to me is a tremendous story, but it doesn't stop with the war, because when he came home, like your dad came home for World War I, my dad came home from World War II, those people who had been there and had seen that kind of suffering, they loved liberty. And they came home to families, they came home to wives and children and parents and grandparents, and they began to build things. They began to say, my life was spared. And it was not uncommon in your dad's experience. The casualty rates were incredibly high in World War I.
That's true.
When you come back from that, you think about that, you realize you were spared and must have been spared for a reason, and you get busy. Your dad did that for sure. He came home and started building a company, which became multiple companies and lots of people with lots and lots of jobs. And the ethic of what he started is still vibrant today. And I think that's part of it too. It's the war of ideas. It's the battle of the spirit. It's the prayer and the spiritual renewal and revival. And then it's doing the duty to live out what it means to be free.
Let's go back over to his uniform. There's a very significant little brooch on the uniform, and we know now from the war letters the story behind this brooch, namely that a young girl stepped out and picked my dad out of the soldiers to personally thank for helping secure their freedom. So Mons, Belgium, maybe 8 or 9 years old. And she said, I'd like you to have this. And it's a silver brooch with her picture in it, which he promptly pinned on his uniform. And I just have to believe that this was maybe a highlight, maybe the highlight of his 3 years abroad. It not only marks the end of the war, but it marks the human element of a young girl stepping forward to say thank you.
You know, what is inspiring about this story is not just the happy ending that Reg made at home and back to his family, but that his family discovered this wonderful story, and now it's a part of the legacy being taught to the grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and to all of us through the Beckett Companies.
If your station is one of the few that has to cut away at this point, you can hear the fifth and final segment and find out more about the War Letters book at thepublicsquare.com. The rest of you, stay tuned.
Once again, here's Dave Zanotti with guest John Beckett and his book, The War Letters.
I felt that after writing the book that you've so kindly commented on, there was one additional piece that was important, and that was to try to tie together some of the character qualities that I saw in my dad firsthand. He's been gone for over 50 years, so I was young when I was seeing them, but they're memorable all the same. But to tie those in to what I now know were experiences that he was encountering in the Western Front. And I made a list of what some of those qualities might have been. There were 8 or 10 of them. I picked 3 to do a short film on. And those 3 were ones that we've already touched on here today. But first of all, love for family. I mean, that was his lifeline, the support that he was getting from home. And it was mutual. It went both ways. The second was a sense of responsibility. And we've spoken about that as well. Probably the high water mark was his enlisting in the first place, when he didn't need to, and when the context for enlisting was a ugly war that was had no end in sight, and yet he went into a recruiting office and enlisted. So that sense of responsibility. And then the third is perseverance. And He used a term, I thought he made it up, he spoke about stick-to-itiveness. It actually is a word in the dictionary. But he drilled that into me, you know, don't give up, you just stay with it. And yet when you see the context for having to persevere in that war, you see where it was forged. So anyway, I tried to thread some of those lessons together against the backdrop of his war experience. And so the material that we have assembled, the book that was just a labor of love to write, and then this short 20-minute film constitute, I would say, the culmination of a venture I never expected to be on a few years ago. But I discovered those war letters, and it was like, something's got to be done. It's sort of like you're standing at the base of Kilimanjaro and saying, someday I'm going to get up that mountain. You know, someday, God willing, live long enough. And many people came forth with support materials. But I don't know that there could be a finer tribute to a period of time that he never mentioned. All had to be threaded together with a piece here, a piece there. But I just feel that I now have a much clearer line of sight to what made him the man that he was and what gave him the capacity to go through the Depression when he was without work for years to start a company literally on a shoestring. He brought in a business partner because his partner had some finances, and I think it was $10,000 for which he gave his partner 50% of the company. So pretty inexpensive equity based on what we see now. And yet he had nothing. He started in. Then in the Second War, we couldn't keep the company going because copper, steel, materials were rationed for the war effort. And most people, I think, probably would have thrown up their hands and said, well, the fates are against us. We're going to have to close up shop. He actually went into a totally different line of business. He insulated homes for all the remaining years of the Second War and then went back into our core business. I love that story because he wasn't going to give up. It was the lesson that he learned and became part of who he was. He was going to persevere through it. And I can look back over a corporate history and see time after time after time when it seemed like we were up against absolutely insurmountable obstacles and found a way through. So it's been a life lesson for me, but I think it's also a commentary on how we need to think as Christians, how we need to think as Americans. And it's not just kind of a unrealistic optimism. It's a core belief that there is a way through. And it's sometimes when the circumstances are absolutely the darkest that you find that window of light and find your way through. So these are lessons that I feel privileged to have been able to observe firsthand and experience, and hopefully shape the way that we've gone about our work and raised our own family.
Well, true to the tradition of our relationship, you wrote a coffee table book for your grandchildren. I read it and said, we got to get this out there. And I've been dragging you. And we need more people to see it. And there's a way that they can view the war letters online, which is exciting. You can actually go to the war letters and get a PDF document and read it for yourself. Obviously, if they download it online, the proof of the positive is you didn't buy it. So this isn't something that was created as a profit center. Now, how about the video? Can people find the video and see it? Because that's compelling as well.
Yeah, well, we have a site where there's a direct link and they can view it online. It was professionally done, by the way. We wanted to take this up a notch from the YouTube video world, which I'm grateful for. It is available online, and we would welcome people to see it, use it, and perhaps apply it in some ways.
I just was studying some speeches of Ronald Reagan last night and realized that come or go, up or down, for the last 28 years, there has not been a person at the podium that had a clue compared to how that man could communicate. But I'm mindful of his farewell speech 8 years later, where he said that America, the true teaching of America, is at the dinner table. And that's what he was most afraid of as he left office, was the eradication of the American memory. That was his greatest concern.
I've not known that quote, but that is precious.
In his farewell address.
Does your family have meals together?
Yeah.
And yet that is where so much, not just taught, but it gets imparted.
This material would be fantastic because it's accessible, it's lovely, it's readable. It's scary but not terrifying. It's sobering but joyful. It's like in the end, it's like a warm blanket. It's like, okay, we got through that and there's hope. But yet it's a calling because it doesn't end with a victory in war. It doesn't end with simply a happy ending of people getting off the boats and hugging and kissing. It begins another stage of the journey of duty and walking out life and walking out liberty. It's a beautiful story of what a life of faith well lived should look like. And that's why I'm going to keep dragging it out of you, John Beckett, because I want more people to hear the story and see what the Lord has been doing through your family.
Thank you.
Today on The Public Square, we hope you have been inspired, as we have, by the telling of the story of Reg Beckett and the war letters. Our thanks to John and Wendy Beckett and their entire family for sharing this inspiring story with us and the world.
To watch the short film that John mentioned in this segment or learn more about the War Letters book, visit thepublicsquare.com.
The Public Square is a listener-supported broadcast, and you are welcome to share today's program with those you love free of charge. And to make a donation in support of this broadcast, just log on to thepublicsquare.com and you can give there. Thanks for listening to The Public Square.
Is calling, calling home, soldier, come
Public Square is a broadcast service of the American Policy Roundtable.